Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of April. This hour of the program, President Barack Obama is probably at this moment on his way to Cape Canaveral. He's going to be addressing the changes to NASA this afternoon in a space conference session. And both our guests this hour are going to be present. They will be members and participants in President Obama's space conference in Florida. We'll be talking about the proposed changes. There's been a lot of news about these because some former astronauts, Neil Armstrong, the commander of Apollo 11, James Lovell, commander of Apollo 13, wrote to Obama along with other astronauts asking him to reconsider scrapping investment in the Constellation program that would include trips to the moon. Robert Gibbs, in a press conference yesterday, said the commission itself that was to study the future of NASA found that the idea of going to the moon under the timetable prescribed was unexecutable. That's their word, he said. Another astronaut, Buzz Aldrin, is a supporter of the budget. It is a budget that we're going to examine this hour of the program in the future of NASA, and we should have a terrific show. Both our guests are in Cape Canaveral, and they will be participants in the session this afternoon with the president. We have half-hour guests, and we will start with Louis Friedman, who is the founder and the executive director of the Planetary Society. From 63 to 68, he worked at the Avco Space Systems divisions on both civilian and military space programs. From 70 to 80, he was at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory involved in planning deep space missions. His projects included Mariner, Venus, Mercury, the Grand Tour, Voyager, Venus Orbital Imaging Radar, Magellan, and Halley Comet Rendezvous Solar Sail, and the Mars program. What a way to spend your working life, huh? In 78, he went to Washington, D.C. as a congressional fellow and worked on the staff of the Subcommittee on Science, Technology, and Space of the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. And he frequently testifies before Congress on issues concerning the space science community and the members of the Planetary Society. Louis Friedman, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much for those nice remarks. I just want to correct a little bit and say that I co-founded the Planetary Society along with Carl Sagan and Bruce Murray.
Oh, we want to include those people, too. That's quite, you've had quite a life, sir, haven't you?
Well, thank you. The joy of being involved in space exploration is terrific. I mean, both to accomplish things on space missions that go out exploring other worlds, but also to be involved in trying to make new missions happen, as we are trying to do down here at the Kennedy Space Center.
Right. Now, the president is speaking this afternoon. There are a number of people who have been intimately involved in the space program who will be listening to him, right?
Yes. There's a couple of hundred people down here and a couple of and many thousands across the country, as well as, of course, the workers and the many workers who are involved both at the Kennedy Space Center and at the contractors who are concerned about their jobs and contracts of the different companies.
And tell me about that job loss. We've heard a bit about that the shuttle program will lose many people, the Constellation program also. Are we looking at huge job losses?
Well, first of all, the shuttle decision was made 6 years ago, so that should be understood by everybody. A lot of people think that President Obama made that decision. No, that was made 6 years ago, and it's just coming to realization now because this is the year it's supposed to be retired. And yes, there will be job shifts. I don't know about job losses. Actually, more money has been proposed by President Obama to go into the space program. Stimulation of both commercial interests and commercial money, as well as government money, is increasing. So both the government money will be greater and the commercial money will be greater, and now it's going to be up to the cleverness of all involved to start those developments. There should be more jobs as a result of it, and I think the president today is going to make that point, that the net increase in jobs will be greater. Some contractors lose and other contractors gain, of course, but that's been typical for, you know, years, for decades, in both the military and in space and in many other areas, even in healthcare.
Tell me about this Constellation program. If I'm reading it correctly, there were billions of dollars spent on this. It's not getting anywhere. It may never get anywhere. It's being scrapped. It seems as though we've wasted a lot of money on this. Two-part question. One is, was it wise for us to go back to the moon with this program? And two, why scrap it?
Well, it is going to be lost money. Some will be. Of course, no money is spent in space. It's all spent on Earth, and things have been learned, and there have developments, and some of that money will not be wasted. But there's no question. It's a loss. But the real question is do you, just because you're losing money, do you continue to chase good money after bad? If an investment isn't working out, you usually get out of that investment. And unfortunately, Constellation, which had great vision, ended up being short-sighted because it was not funded well enough. The program started to slip. They ran into technical problems. Cost was increasing. They weren't going to get the rocket built in time to even get up to the space station before its mission was over, let alone it wasn't going to get to the moon, as it intended, of at least until a decade later than was intended. And it wouldn't have gotten beyond the moon. Remember, the moon is something the United States did 40 years ago, and it wasn't even going to match that accomplishment for another 20 years. So it was time to change. A reset was definitely necessary, and this is a pretty bold plan, but that's probably what is needed in order for we're ever going to get humans beyond Earth orbit.
I know that you've been very involved in deep space planning and deep space missions. What is the Obama plan for deep space?
Well, one of the things that has us quite positive about it is that you remember way back in the Apollo era, we had something called the Saturn V. It was a rocket that could go out of Earth orbit. We don't have a rocket that can do that anymore. If astronauts have not gone beyond Earth orbit since the days of Apollo, because we have no rocket that's capable of taking them there. So the new budget proposed by President Obama and his remarks today are actually going to increase the emphasis on that. Are building a deep space rocket. It's called the Heavy Lift Launch Vehicle. I think they'll have a more exciting name for it when they actually decide on it. But it'll be a deep space rocket that will be capable of going not just to the moon again, but beyond the moon, taking the first time ever to take astronauts into interplanetary space, first to get just beyond the Earth's gravity, then at the asteroids, then maybe in a step-by-step path that leads to Mars. Mars is the ultimate destination. It's the only planet that humans can ever make it on if we think about the future, and the questions of life on Mars still tantalize us. But Mars is a long way off, and the step-by-step approach that they propose in this new plan, I think, will get has the best chance of getting us there, because it'll involve technical developments that will keep building up along the way.
Mars is how long a way off?
Well, do you mean when will we get there?
Yes.
Or do you mean how long does the trip take?
Oh, let's answer both questions.
I'll answer both questions.
Okay.
A typical round-trip mission to Mars is 2.5 to 3 years. You have to take about 6 to 8 months to get out there. Then you have to wait for the Earth to be in the right position to make the similarly long mission back, and so you may spend a year out there in the orbit of Mars, or even on the surface of Mars, if depending on how that is decided. So it's a 2 to 3 year round trip mission, and we have to build up that capability step by step, just as we built up the capability to go to the moon back in the 60s, step by step. When will this occur? There are enthusiasts like me, who, you know, rocket engineers who will say, oh, we can do it in 10 years. But reality is the political system is not going to put that kind of money into it, and it probably shouldn't. It probably should be done more methodically. And I would say that a reasonable goal would be to do it in 25 years. But if we do nothing for 25 years, it'll still be 25 years in the future. We need to first get the astronauts just beyond the moon. We need to get them out into interplanetary space. Mm-hmm. That could be done in less than 10 years. Hmm. And that would be great if we could get the astronauts working in interplanetary space by the year 2020 or 2022. We'd be on our way.
There seems to be some fundamental concern, Louis Friedman, about what the role of NASA will be, that a lot of this would be contracted out to private contractors without the expertise of the people who've been working in this industry at NASA for years and years and years.
Well, let's say that the NASA program is being redirected. It's now going toward exploration, going out into the solar system and creating the capabilities to explore other worlds instead of transportation. Yes, the transportation part of the program is now going to be headed into the commercial sector. But that's fine. We get services from the commercial sector for many of the things that that we do, including our telephones, including our communications, for example. So transportation is probably at the time when we can use commercial launch vehicles. We have a rich supply of Atlases and Deltas with a heritage that goes all the way back to the days of Mercury and Gemini to take us to Earth orbit. So I don't think it's particularly revolutionary to suggest that maybe that's the time to do that. The government will be in the business of exploration, which is what it should be, and that refocusing, I think, is a welcome development.
Mm-hmm. And what about this deal that we're going to have with the Russians?
Well, that's actually a decision that was made also many years ago when we first, in fact, it was in the 1980s when we had the first Challenger accident with the shuttle, and then later on when we had the Columbia accident with the shuttle. The Russians became our transportation mode to Earth orbit. So we've done this before. We've done it several times. The Russians have proved to be very reliable and very conscientious partners. Their missions have a remarkable launch record and success at getting astronauts to the space station and into orbit. So I don't think it's that big a deal to have the Russians be a one of the options for taking our astronauts up. Right now, they're the only option. Development of the commercial launch industry in the United States will give us other options, and then that'll drive the price down. People do complain that the Russians have a monopoly, but even with that monopoly, their cost for our astronauts to go to orbit is cheaper than the space shuttle.
We welcome phone calls. Louis Friedman is our guest. The first part of our program today, both our guests this hour joining us by phone from Cape Canaveral. Well, they will be listening to the president who's speaking at Cape Canaveral this afternoon on the future of NASA, and they will be participating in that space conference. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. We start our calls with Rick from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Oh, good morning. I'd like to make a couple points if I could here. The first one is really sort of cultural. You know, I can hardly think of anything much more sort of nerdy that goes on there at NASA. We're talking people that got PhDs and aeronautical engineering and astrophysics, guys and gals. Wonderful people. I'm not sure that matches up with the demographic of the young people that voted for our new president. But more importantly, there are lots of objects in our solar system just beyond the orbit of Jupiter, the Oort Belt. And, you know, our planet gets peppered probably hundreds of thousands times a year by these smaller rocks, and it's no big deal. They fall on glaciers and whatnot. But there's a real big one that we've already named Apophis that's heading for our planet and scheduled to get here in the year 2029. And it's going to be coming in so close by our mathematical estimates that it may actually temporarily blot out the sun.
What do you think of that, Louis Friedman?
Well, first, a comment on the first part, which is, yes, there are people with, there are nerds and geeks involved in the space program, but there are also many, many ordinary people. And one of the great benefits of space exploration is it involves so much of our community. I'm down here at Kennedy Space Center, and I was talking to some workers who were doing highway repair last night who felt they're part of the space program because they're getting the Kennedy Center ready for a new era of space commercialization. So I think it's not fair to just regard this as a elitist activity. It's really an activity for all people. On the asteroid, yes, Apophis is coming close to the Earth. It's going to miss the Earth. that it's nowhere near big enough to blot out the sun. That's not a worry. But there is money in the new budget. In fact, one of the things we're very pleased with in the president's proposal is greater emphasis on both the robotic missions to discover more about near-Earth asteroids and the potential danger to Earth, but also even a human mission to a near-Earth asteroid as a technical milestone on the way to Mars. So we'll learn a lot more, and we'll have a lot more capability if this budget passes.
Thanks for the call. Larry from Madison. Hi, Larry.
Thank you. Well, I question the value of sending humans into interplanetary space. Seems to me that we could learn just as much by sending scientific instrumentation. I worked on the Apollo program, and at the time, the estimates were that that program was costing three times as much as it would have if we were sending only instruments to the moon. I think sending humans appeals to the romantic adventurism
sure.
that we all share, and incidentally appeals to Congress and serves to help get bigger budgets for NASA. But I really don't think that when everything is considered, it's worth the cost of sending humans into interplanetary space.
What did you do with the Apollo program, Larry?
I was working for one of the prime contractors, Rockwell International, and we were building some of the major systems for Apollo.
Hmm. Lewis.
Well, yeah, this is a long-debated point. I will point out that there's probably 5% of the people, not just in the United States, but even in Russia, who remember that the Soviet Union did robotic missions to the moon and brought back samples from the moon, just like our Apollo astronauts did, but they did it robotically. Nobody remembers that because it was with robots, and the people, whereas Apollo stood as a symbol of America's greatness for decades afterwards, somehow the people identification drives everything, and I don't feel bad about that because I'm human myself and therefore a chauvinist about human achievement. But there's another point, too, which is it may be 10 times as costly to do it with humans, but humans do things 100 or even 1,000 times faster and cleverer than robots do. Even the leader of the Mars Science Rover team has estimated that what their rovers have done in a year could have been done by humans in less than a week, in terms of both distance covered and in terms of the geological investigations. So it's not obvious that we should just turn it over to the robots to do, and I hope we don't for at least many centuries to come.
Plus, those human beings can tell us what they see.
And so there's a scientific reason, and of course there is this geopolitical reason. Human space, there's a reason that even China and India, countries that don't have anywhere near the resources that the United States has, are now developing human spaceflight programs. They're not doing it because they're only for science. They're doing it for their geopolitical importance, and I think that's true in America, too.
More phone calls in a moment. Lewis Friedman, one of our guests this hour, as we talk about what the president is likely to say at the Kennedy Space Center this afternoon as he outlines a future direction, which is really a exploration direction now for NASA. Lewis Friedman is the co-founder and executive director of the Planetary Society, and he's done work in planning deep space missions. He's been very involved in the whole space program since 1963. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls. Our next caller is it Vusa from Wausau?
Yes.
Hi, Vusa. Go ahead.
Hi. I have two questions that might sound very primitive to your speaker, but nevertheless, I'm going to ask because it's not my field of industry. The first question is that he indicated that it takes about 3.5 years to go back and forth to Mars. The question is, like, how do they refuel their machines? It's not like there's gas stations for kilometers.
That's,
I mean, do they have
not a primitive question.
No,
at all.
It's not at all.
Very, very good question. The old-fashioned way is you carry it all with you, and that is the way we did it on the moon, and that's the only way we have the technology to do it today, which is we load the rocket up with fuel, and we have to carry it with us to not just to Mars, but land it on the surface of Mars. And as you might imagine, that's an enormous payload penalty. It's the factors of hundreds increases the weight of our vehicle. The way we would like to do it requires a new technology. It's called in-situ propellant production. You actually make your propellant, your fuel, on the surface of Mars using the oxygen in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You get the oxygen from it. You use the water that not only in the atmosphere a little bit, but below the surface. You use indigenous resources on the surface of Mars to maybe you have to carry your hydrogen there, or maybe you don't. Maybe you can make it out of the oxygen and methane and other gases that are there. But you use the gases that are on Mars to make fuel. That's going to take a little technology development. In fact, it's going to take a lot of technology development. That's one of the reasons we shouldn't do the mission very, very quickly. But that's being started in the new program. That's one of the commitments that's in the new budget, and it'll be tried out on a robotic mission first, and slowly we'll build up that capability to make fuel on another planet.
Mm. So we could do that on the moon as well? Could we have it?
Well, unfortunately, the moon doesn't have the resources that Mars has. The moon has no atmosphere, so you can't extract anything out of the atmosphere. They say it might have some water, but these are really little water molecules in very isolated regions, not certainly enough to make fuel on the surface of the moon. I think the idea of making resources on the surface of the moon is much, much more difficult, and because the moon is not as far away and you don't need as much, probably wouldn't be the efficient way to do it at the moon anyway. We could still do it the old-fashioned way if for some reason we do need to go back to
the moon. Right. Lucy, you had another question?
Yes, I had. Well, this is kind of more like question and also like comment. Is it possible, so to speak? You know, obviously an integral part of all the missions that Lewis indicated is money. In all, you know, reality, if money was not an issue, that'll be probably done within not 20 years or within a few years. What I'm asking, is it not, since relying on a state or government budget is somewhat a joke because of the triple minuses we have, is it not possible to organize some sort of a quote-unquote Disney-like trips where you'll say, okay, we have this you know, mission now, let's say not so far from Earth, where private parties can take a trip to at a very, you know, exceeding high cost, let's say. And obviously in this country we have private billionaires who would, just for the heck of it, will do it.
Well, we don't have enough of them who will do that just for the heck of it. But you're quite right that there could be a commercial advantage, especially in near space, near the Earth. And that's one of the reasons that this new plan is tapping the commercial industry. They are hoping that, I guess analogous again to the telephones or communication business, that there'll be both private and public participants in it and thereby drive down the cost. And so the commercial rocket suppliers who can do the types of things, whether it's Disney or whether it's hotels or whether it's trips, whatever it might be, that they will be able to do their thing while the government concentrates on the science and the exploration of discoveries in on other worlds. And both industries will benefit both in lowering the cost and accomplishing more.
Hmm. Finally, to you, Lewis Friedman, is there a question you want to ask and hope to ask the president today?
I don't think, I guess if I, that's a good question. I have to think about what I really will ask the president if I get the opportunity to do it. But I think the main thing I would do is to encourage this leadership that he's shown by making the move out into interplanetary space for the first time, an American objective. And I would just ask one question of the president. How can I help?
How can you help? And he'll need your help, that's for sure. What a career you've had, sir. It's a great honor to speak with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and you've been very nice, and I appreciate that.
Louis Friedman, founder and executive director of the Planetary Society. One of the other co-founders was Carl Sagan, and he is in the Kennedy Space Center. The president, of course, speaking there this afternoon to talk about the future of NASA, which will now concentrate on space exploration. There is a great deal of concern. Louis Friedman said that the possibility of job losses is simply not as great as people have said that it would be. There is concern about the shift of this program and the shift in the nature of what NASA is. We're talking about that in anticipation of the president's remarks coming this afternoon at the Kennedy Space Center. Don't worry about your phone calls because they're still applicable to the next half hour. We're just changing our guests and we'll continue taking your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Our guest now is Professor G. Scott Hubbard, professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford University, the Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe, the SETI Institute. His research has included the study of both human and robotic exploration of space, with a particular focus on advanced technology and national policy. In this area, he has an ongoing engagement with robotic Mars missions as a member of the National Academy of Science Review Groups and is a frequent contributor to NASA projects. He's engaged in the field of astrobiology through identification of techniques that may serve to detect the fingerprints of life. He also advocates the understanding of regional climate change and its economic impact and is an expert on the emerging entrepreneurial space industry and conducts research that examines proposed business cases. He also is at the Kennedy Space Center and will be a part of the space gathering that will take place this afternoon as the president addresses the future of the program. Professor G. Scott Hubbard, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Kathleen.
You know, I read what you do for a living and what your background is, and I think, I wish I could have done that in my life. It is extraordinarily interesting and involved work, isn't it? It's just marvelous.
Well, thank you. It has been an amazing 35 years. 20 of those I spent with NASA, and I've enjoyed almost every minute.
Yeah, almost every minute. I won't ask you about those that you haven't. I don't think I will later. What about this afternoon? Do you imagine you're going to enjoy what the president has to say?
I think so. I think so. I'm going to be on one of the panels that will discuss the president's speech after the event. And we've gotten a little preview from the White House on the talking points, and they look like a list of things that I feel very positive about.
Mm-hmm. Would it be safe to say, just generally, that it involves a shift in NASA to space exploration?
Absolutely. Putting NASA out at the, if you will, the pointy end of the spear, moving out humans beyond low Earth orbit, continuing the robotic exploration of the solar system, and of course with the great observatories in space like Hubble looking out into the universe beyond, and developing new technologies. And what it's doing partially to make this feasible is to get the commercial sector involved in low Earth orbit, the, if you will, the trucking business of going back and forth between the surface of the Earth and the space station, for example.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about those new technologies. Do we know what they need to be, even?
We really do. We've been talking about this. I have been in innumerable discussions when I was with NASA about what we need to do next. And let me give you just two or three quick examples. One is we need a heavy lift rocket. We need the ability to get a lot of mass, people and cargo to asteroids, perhaps the moon, and then ultimately to Mars. And then we need advanced intelligent systems. So we need the capability of operating rovers maybe from the orbit around Mars, and we need life support. If you're going to go on this long round trip to Mars that may take several years, you've got to be able to get breathable air and provide drinking water and so forth for the crew.
Right. So what is the role of NASA then in achieving that? How much is commercial involvement and how much is NASA?
Well, NASA funds things that are unique for space exploration. They can have a lot of spin-offs. Those have happened in the past. A lot of the microelectronics industry got its start from NASA investment in the 60s, and that'll probably happen again. But then NASA also leans on what the commercial sector can provide. And I think in this case, the commercial rockets that launch things like communications satellites and national security satellites can be converted to human and cargo lift to low Earth orbit. And there you want to take advantage of investments that have been made by others and will continue to be made by others.
And are there enough businesses to, I know you're an expert on the emerging entrepreneurial space industry, how much is it just emerging? How much does it need to develop?
Well, let's talk about two pieces of commercial space. One piece is already there. If you look at a pie chart, we're all familiar with those, at the whole space enterprise worldwide, it's about $250 billion. And way over half, about 60% of that, is commercial space. All of our GPS, all of our television signals and so forth rely heavily on commercial satellites that are put up there without any government involvement. So that's very different than it was 50 years ago. What's emerging are things like these suborbital. That's where you go up to the edge of space to about 100 miles or so, have 4 minutes of weightlessness, and come back down. Groups like Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic is pioneering this. And that, I think, is something, a business that is going to happen. They've got hundreds of people signed up, putting their money down in deposit to take this type of ride, and I think that that's going to be a kind of extreme adventure that people will experience in the next, say, 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Why do you believe so many astronauts, not all, but what about this letter that was delivered to the president, and I guess NBC got a copy of it, to astronauts really expressing displeasure of the new direction of the space program?
Well, I know from all of my years in space research, a lot of astronauts, and I would say they're, I haven't taken a nose count, but they're divided down the middle.
Mm.
Many of the original astronaut corps, the Apollo astronauts, are very concerned because we have to respect enormously and deeply their contributions, but their contributions came in a Cold War environment. It's a different world now. The shuttle astronauts, many of them are, in fact, working for these emerging entrepreneurial companies. There are astronauts working for SpaceX. That's this group founded by the PayPal's entrepreneur, Elon Musk. There are astronauts working for Orbital Sciences. In this morning's newspaper, Buzz Aldrin took great issue with Neil Armstrong. So the two heroes from Apollo 11 are on opposite sides of the argument.
We hear, and Louis Friedman, who was on prior to you, said that he thought there could be job creation from this. A lot of news reports are saying that tens of thousands of people, because of cancellation of Constellation and Space Shuttle, people who are working on that, are going to be unemployed.
Well, let's drop back to the Columbia tragedy. I served as the only NASA person on the Columbia board. I spent 7 months working on that and trying to figure out what happened and make recommendations. And one of our recommendations was the shuttle is an aging, high-risk, and very expensive vehicle. It costs $2.5 to $3 billion a year. That's billion with a B, whether it flies or not. And it's that expensive because it takes thousands and thousands of people to literally wiggle each of 20 or 30,000 tiles that protect the shuttle during reentry to be sure that they're safe for the next flight. In 2004, President Bush said in his speech that we are going to retire the shuttle based on the recommendations of the Columbia Board, and I still support those recommendations for the reasons I said. So those kinds of jobs are going away, and that's been known for 6 years. The new jobs, though, with this investment in advanced technology and a new heavy lift launch rocket and in going beyond low Earth orbit to Mars ultimately, will be new 21st century high technology jobs. So there's going to be a transition, and transitions are always difficult, but I think ultimately we'll have 21st century high-paying, high-tech jobs.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Craig from Shorewood is our first caller for you. Hi, Craig.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I think the previous guest mentioned that a trip to Mars and back would be about 2 to 3 years in duration. I thought I had recently read about a new rocket engine technology. I think it might be called the Ion engine. I don't know if I have that right. But I thought with the Ion engine, you wouldn't need to carry as much fuel, and it also could propel a craft faster and reduce the travel time to Mars and back to maybe half the time. Are you aware of any of that alternate engine technology and what the prospects are for that?
Yes. The agency, NASA, and all of its various universities and contractor partners have looked at things like solar electric propulsion. That's where you take sunlight and then using a very special type of gas like krypton, not kryptonite, but krypton, you actually make these little ions that very slowly will build up quite a bit of speed. This technology has already been proven. NASA had a mission called Deep Space One, and the Europeans had a mission called Smart One that used this. It's terrific for a robotic mission, but no one has yet figured out how to scale this up to the size of a rocket that you would need for taking humans to Mars. It's not impossible. You might have a different version of this using radioactive material. So I think the part of this budget is to invest in those technologies, but also to make some progress in exploration using what we've got on the books today.
Thanks, Craig, for your call. Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello. If you've had two fine guests. May I ask two, I think, related questions? One general and the second perhaps more specific. Hasn't it been the case since the days of Van Allen that the investment in robots and instrumented space flight has all returned much more in terms of knowledge, you know, and return on the taxpayer's dollar than the manned space program? And second, are we in a situation where the United States would be duplicating a capacity that Russia has already developed? Certainly they have those large boosters for deep space. We have borrowed from them in that the current space station is actually pretty much Mir 2. So how much innovation will come from this new program? And is it fundamentally instrument robot-based rather than dedicated to a manned deep space mission? So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank. Good questions.
Yeah, those are great questions. Let's deal with the first one. 50 years ago, you had Van Allen on one side and Von Braun on the other side, arguing all robots, all humans. The actual answer, I think, is in the middle. And to understand that, we have to talk about why do we explore or use space in the first place. I have always been very engaged in the science side of the house, and so my reasons personally have to do with collecting science data about Mars and the moon and so forth. And there you can make the argument that you can be very effective with robotic missions. However, in the workshops I've held and working with students and with the public, science is not the only reason that we explore space. We explore space because of national interest, because of return on investment, to some extent because of inspiration. And it's the national interest piece that often has been one of the prime motivating factors for human exploration. That's why I think that you see China and India entering that competition, because there's something about owning a human spaceflight program that's a mark of accomplishment in the international community. Having said that, let's imagine that for a variety of reasons you put a human on the surface of Mars or orbiting the surface of Mars. What can they do? Well, I have investigated this question with all kinds of computer robot experts and talked to the people like Steve Squires, who've operated the rovers on Mars for the last several years. And I'm convinced that a human being could do in a few days what it takes the Spirit and Opportunity rovers on Mars months to do. You know, human beings have an incredible ability to operate and to adapt in a completely unknown environment. Robots sit there waiting for you to tell them what to do. So I think that given that, because it's in our national interest to have human exploration, that we can have a lot of science return on investment when those humans get to Mars. Second question about duplicating Russian capacity. Again, I think that it is in our national interest to have a launch capability and a thriving space sector. There are a lot of jobs and a lot of income involved in that. What we need to do is to take advantage of the ability that commercial operations do to reduce costs. And I think as far as working with other countries, we're going to be more international. The International Space Station proved we can do it. I can see these missions in the future being much more cooperative internationally.
Mm. And what do the other countries think of that? Are they ready to be cooperative completely?
Yes, they are. Mm. I have good colleagues in the European Space Agency. That includes the French, the Italians. I know the Russian, some of the Russian scientists as well. And they look to the United States to lead. And if we lead, they'll be part of it.
That's a change, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Right. More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about the future of NASA, the future of space, as the president travels to the Kennedy Space Center this afternoon to address a gathering of prestigious scientists, people who have been in the space area for many, many years. And one of those prestigious guests is with us today, Professor G. Scott Hubbard, consulting professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford University, the Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe at the SETI Institute. He is at the Kennedy Space Center and awaiting the president's arrival this afternoon. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have a few more minutes for your phone calls. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we talk about the all-important profession of teaching and ask the question, what makes a good teacher? And how do you train a person to be a good teacher? Back to phone calls. Paul from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Kathleen. My favorite Wisconsin Public Radio space cadet.
Thanks, Paul.
I can hear it in your voice. Anyway, I would like to ask your guest, why is the NASA channel, which I get by satellite, so crushingly boring? I tune it in from time to time to see what they're doing, and a lot of times I'm looking at a control room and nothing's happening, or spacewalks are exciting, but boy, they really don't do a whole lot for me from here on Earth. I wish you could find Miles O'Brien one of the biggest mistakes CNN ever did was get rid of him as their science correspondent and spiff up that network and or that channel and really, really make it interesting for the average viewer. That's my main comment. I have been a fan of the space program ever since it started. I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, I have to agree with you. I spent 20 years with NASA, and there have been high points where the story was engaging, the visuals were tremendous, and people paid a lot of attention. I've been part of the Mars program for years and years, first inside NASA and now on as a professor. And, boy, when those rovers are doing something and you get the images coming back, it's just terrific to see that. It's exciting, and it's you're seeing something for the first time. I mean, can you imagine the data comes in, it appears on your TV screen, and it's the first time any human being has ever seen this landscape of an alien world, the red planet. On the other hand, as you point out, many times there's not much going on. And I will see Miles O'Brien later today at this event. And I'm also going to, I'm sure, run into some of the current headquarters officials. And I will make this comment to them that if they could just put a little, that there are lots of visuals out there. NASA owns I don't know how many millions of miles of pictures, videotape, and so forth, and try to program that to really reflect the interest. I know somebody once commented that it doesn't seem possible that you could take something as exciting as space exploration and make it boring. And I think that getting the word out in a more effective way would be good. One final comment I will make, though. I had this discussion with my good friend Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he pointed out that when they put the picture of the cupola, this is the picture window on the space station, they put that on Twitter, it went viral, and that millions of people saw that. So maybe there are some of these new social networking tools are going to be effective. We'll see.
Right. Well, all of those pictures, and they're in the newspaper maybe for a little while, but all the pictures from Hubble, for heaven's sake, they're just extraordinary, I think. And you would just think that they would be all over the place, and we'd be looking at them intently, constantly.
And they are on archives. If you go to the NASA website and navigate down, you can find huge archives of those pictures. And what you need, I think, NASA is populated by very dedicated people, from technicians working on the shuttle through scientists and engineers and so forth. But it doesn't have a large cadre of people that do what you do, Kathleen, which is to explain this to the rest of the world. And maybe they need to put some investment in that.
Yes. What's going to happen today where you are? What time is the president arriving? Is there going to be a big discussion about the future of the space program?
As I understand it, from the media reports that have been put out, Air Force One will land at about 1:45 Eastern Time, and there will be some greetings and so forth with the media present, and then the president will give his speech about an hour later, and then there's going to be some panels to discuss the various aspects of exploration. I'm on a panel chaired by the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, John Holdren, and a couple of us are going to talk about things like human and robotic exploration and why is Mars important and what is this flexible path, and so that will go on for another hour or two, and the president will go back, as I understand it, around 4 o'clock or so to Washington.
Oh, it should be a wonderful day. I'd love to be there. Many of our listeners would, too. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a great, great interview. Thanks.
thank you. I enjoyed being on, and good luck to you, and because teachers are important.
Yes, they are.
Hour.
Teachers are very important. Our guest this half hour, we had to leave about a minute early, so I'm sorry we couldn't take all of your phone calls. G. Scott Hubbard, consulting professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford University, Carl Sagan Chair for the Study of Life in the Universe at the SETI Institute. He has worked for a long time with NASA on planning in the robotic Mars missions that became a reality. He has been working as a member of the National Academy of Science review groups and a frequent consultant to NASA projects, engaged in the field of astrobiology through identification of techniques that may serve to detect the fingerprints of life. We thank him for his time today, and thanks also to Lewis Friedman, executive director of the Planetary Society and co-founder of the Society, along with Carl Sagan. Well, that was fascinating, wasn't it? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show and getting really top-notch guests who are joining us both by phone from the Kennedy Space Center, where they will be participating and being in panel discussions after they hear the president speak on the future of NASA. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee and for all of your calls. We thank you as well. Maybe we should put some pictures on our Facebook, some Hubble pictures or something, just to remember this show. Can we do that, Chrissy? We could do that. Let's do that. You can go to our Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll post some pictures. And you can always continue the discussion there as well. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This is the Ideas Network.